Join us again next Monday morning when the Old Mole Variety Hour returns with views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm going to leave you with the song Trouble in the Water by Hip Hop Caucus. Thanks for listening.
Water moves, new world order rules. Through hurricanes, the pain is made audible. Sound waves, Chi-Town graves dug deep. Water dirty like the police that fly streets. Blood on the beach, sandstorms on the streets. A man's form can be transformed with the heat of the moment. We think our opponent is overseas, but we messing with Mother Nature's ovaries. It's a cruel winter, summer don't know itself. I say get green, but all know is wealth. I know I'm supposed to help, that's what I'm made for. I'm a made man, but I ain't a maid though. God's gift to this earth, that's what she prayed for. They ain't been stable since Cain killed Abel.
Trouble in the water.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM. Share with us your memories, experience, and journey of your life. First and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listener. So please show your support for this amazing community resource by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. The Wall Street investors driving the climate crisis and big timber corporations clear-cutting Pacific Northwest forests are coming to Portland for the annual Who Will Own the Forest Conference, now called Canopy, on September 24th to the 26th. These big polluters hope to stall real climate action by pushing false climate solutions like biomass and carbon offsets to generate even more profits at the expense of communities, the climate, and our forests. Today we talk with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer with Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about what has become another annual event, a rally and workshop to confront these Wall Street elites and call out their false climate solutions. Alex, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks, Barbara. It's great to be here.
Well, the first thing I want to ask you about this conference that's about to happen is, why do they change the name from Who Will Own the Forest?
Right. That's what this conference hosted by the World Forestry Center has been called for decades now, for years. And this year they are changing the name. They're rebranding as Canopy, Forests, Markets, and Society.
Let's unpack that.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about there.
I think about canopy. I think, like, these guys have no idea what canopy means in terms of the forest. Are they referring to the forest canopy?
I don't know that it's meant to have a strong message. I think it's a name that is designed to be bland and vague and entirely unobjectionable. I think that's the point of their rebranding. I think they realized after, you know, hundreds of people gathering outside, the conference being disrupted, people being blocked from getting inside, and all the press attention that garnered, that calling it Who Will Own the Forest is just a little too on the nose and saying the quiet part out loud. Certainly from looking at the agenda and the sponsors and, you know, the folks who go every year, it's going to be the same conference. Their intentions aren't changing, but I think it is definitely an exercise in, you know, public perception management more than anything else.
Well, let's talk about what's going to be going on at that conference and who's going to be there.
Yeah. It's interesting. So originally this conference, and for many years, has been really geared towards big, mostly TIMOs and REITs, real estate investment trusts, and timber investment management organizations, Weyerhaeuser, Green Diamond, that are these Wall Street investor owned. They're not even technically timber companies, although, you know, everyone would be forgiven for thinking that's what they are. And then Wall Street investors, and really trying to bring the investors and people with money, with capital looking to make more money, together with these giant timberland owners, to, you know, grow the sector. Everyone makes more money. What we're seeing now is a shift, and I think this kind of touches also intersects with what we were just talking about with the rebranding, in that last year, much more, and this year as well, much more prominent in the agenda of the conference are panels and keynotes about carbon, forest carbon, carbon storage, you know, emerging regulatory frameworks, mostly at the international level, things like biofuels and biomass. So we're seeing this shift away within, you know, this timber investment sector and industry, away from just, you know, getting board feet out, and that being kind of how it's narrowly been defined or conceived, or that's been most of what it's done for decades, and shifting now into these false climate solutions, this effort to how can we frame our dirty polluting business as usual as a net plus for communities and the environment and the climate. So that's going to be prominent this year. They're having some keynotes that are about, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of drama internationally around carbon offsets over the last year. That whole industry has kind of been really shaken up by some really incredible investigative reporting and also some academic work. Specifically, Barbara Haya and the folks that she works with at UC Berkeley, really calling into question how effective carbon offsets are. I mean, not even calling into question, but highlighting how dismally ineffective they are when it comes to ecological and climate impacts, though they certainly make a lot of money for a lot of people. So that's prominent on the agenda. They're also having a keynote about, it's kind of a backdoor way to a conversation around biomass, specifically a keynote or a panel discussion about the ongoing closures of paper and pulp mills in the U.S. South. There's also a big timber industry and has been for many years in the southern U.S. and the southeast U.S. A lot of those paper and pulp mills have been closing down, and specifically this panel at the Who Will Own the Forest Canopy Conference is leaning into, can biomass and biofuels replace that revenue and kind of fill the void there?
Now, why are those mills shutting down?
I'm not sure. That's a great question. My work with the Forest Climate Alliance is more narrowly focused on the Pacific Northwest, so I'm not an expert on the, you know, timber economics of the Southeast. But, I mean, we have seen in general, I mean, at least here, and I'm not sure how similar it is in the South, a lot of the big old trees have already been cut. And with globalization, you know, timber producers here are now also competing with in timber producers in Indonesia and parts of tropical Africa and Brazil. And so I think there's larger macroeconomic stuff there, but I'm not an expert on that, so I'm not fully sure.
Well, back in the day, Georgia Pacific was a Portland-based company, and I think it's called some insurance company now, but it was the Georgia Pacific building, and it was the first skyscraper in Portland, actually. And the reason why Georgia Pacific left was that they had, as you said, cut down all the big trees in the Northwest, and so they moved to the South, where they started cutting down much smaller trees, actually.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the timber industry has a history of, I mean, it's very boom and bust. You know, Weyerhaeuser has had its center of operations and center of gravity previously in Wisconsin and the Northwoods in the Midwest and also Maine. And, you know, there's a pattern here of, you know, with colonization and settlement, these companies come in and cut down everything they can and, you know, wring the most profit that they can out of the forests and the communities there, and then largely move on, and other geographic areas become the focus.
But the South seems to be the last stand, and so now, literally and figuratively speaking, so now they're going to have to change the operations because there's not any... Well, I was in North Carolina about 6 months ago, and I was shocked to see what they call forests there. These skinny little trees... And they're all really planted, or I think they would be planted anyway, they're really close together. And I was scratching my head as I was driving from Virginia down through mm-hmm. North Carolina to Durham. And then my friends who I was staying with took me to the Duke Forest. And there's a big sign when you enter the Duke Forest that describes how this used to be a big old growth forest. And it was a plantation for 300 years. And it's still recovering from the forestry practices, if you want to call them that, that went on while the land was being farmed as a plantation. And it was interesting to me because it was like, that's what I thought it looked like.
Yeah.
But it's so much worse than New England. I mean, it really, I've never seen trees grow so close together. And I wonder if they're so close together, it makes up for the fact that they're so small.
Yeah, potentially. It also depends what they're using them for. I mean, in general, I think there's kind of an assumption that in plantation, any monocrop in any ecosystem is unhealthy and relatively unnatural. Ecosystems are their most vibrant and diverse and resilient when they are diverse, when there's many different species, and when there's trees of many different ages as well as species in a forest. But I mean, again, that there's been a shift ongoing for a while in the Southeast, where a lot of the trees, the logging that happens there is being turned into biomass wood pellets and then shipped to Europe. And that's a trend that actually now is the industry is trying to come to the West Coast. We're kind of facing a thin green line 2.0 instead of fossil fuel export terminals. This time there's now five that I'm aware of. There may have been some other ones that just came out recently. Proposals for biomass pellet export plants up and down the West Coast. And it's a similar thing of, you know, we've got all these trees. They're not a lot of the trees that have grown because the forests have been so degraded. You can't get much structural timber out of them, but they can still be theoretically used for biomass. And there's demand for biomass pellets, specifically in Asia, or, you know, the industry is betting on that there will be a demand there, specifically because you can burn biomass pellets. You can co-fire it with coal, so you don't have to build a new power generator. You know, if you're already running a coal plant, you can just throw in some biomass pellets and suddenly it's green energy.
It's like renewable diesel. They can manufacture that in the same refineries that they've been making fossil diesel for the last 120 years.
Exactly. And that's, I think, a through line with all these false climate solutions, is that mostly the problem that they primarily solve is these polluting industries facing the prospect of going out of business or having to fundamentally change how they operate or what they do, or, you know, having these sunk asset costs that they've invested so much in over the years. That's mainly the problem they solve, is ensuring that the rich can keep making money and getting richer while putting this nice thin green veneer over everything to grant themselves the social license to operate for another 20 years.
Do you have a sense if Drax is going to be an issue at this new Canopy Pool on the Forest Conference? Are they going to be one of the factors about who you can invest in?
They were on the agenda last year. They had one of their executives or vice presidents or something was on a panel last year. They're not, at this point, on a panel yet. They're not listed as a speaker for this year's conference. But we'll see. I think sometimes they have some last-minute additions. And last time I checked recently, they still were some TBA speaker slots, so it's possible.
When we were talking about a year ago about looking forward to this conference,
yes,
you had never been inside it yet. It was like you were going more from what you could research from the outside. Is that true?
Yes, that is true.
But last year you went inside.
Well, not me personally.
No, not you, but you had comrades who went inside.
Yes. And yes, we got a little bit more of a report back from what it looks like behind the scenes.
So what did they find out from being inside that conference?
The two things that really stood out, one, what I mentioned a minute ago of these folks really see themselves as the heroes. They truly believe that they are on the right side, that, you know, their businesses and business practices are part of the solution to climate change. That's something they really hold. That's a real belief that they have. They truly believe that. It's not just a, you know, well, we don't care, let the world burn as long as we make money. They genuinely believe that plantation forestry is a climate solution, which is, I mean, astounding. I don't know how you can read any of the scientific literature on it and come to that conclusion. But that's one thing. And then, yeah, the other thing that I mentioned a minute ago is how much more carbon management and forests as a climate solution has moved up the agenda. We heard that in past years, those topics have been in the conference for at least a few years, it sounds like. That's what we heard. But in the past, they've always been kind of at the edges of the conference. So the way the conference runs every year is that on the first Tuesday evening, there's an opening reception in the World Forestry Center's museum in the evening. And that's just kind of cocktails and schmoozing and networking. All day on the Wednesday, there's the whole conference, and that's kind of the centerpiece of it that has the highest attendance. The most prominent panels and speakers are there in the middle of the day Wednesday. And then Thursday is a half day. It's just the morning. And then they end at noon or one. And in the past, the carbon related panels have always been kind of at the end, tacked on kind of as an afterthought, and they have moved in the last couple of years much higher up the agenda. And I think that dovetails with, you know, what we've seen nationally and internationally in terms of the amount of money that's being poured into things like, I mean, all these fossil solutions, hydrogen, carbon capture and storage, but within this sector specifically, offsets and biomass, that suddenly these investors are realizing that they can make a lot of money off of those things. So suddenly there's a lot more interest in it.
What do you think it means? That do you think that they are shifting away from cutting down trees to at least claiming that they're managing forests for the sake of preventing worse climate chaos? Or is there something more cynical involved?
I mean, I don't think there's a consensus yet within the industry. It's interesting to have listened to some of the things that Travis Scott, who's the president of the American Forest Resource Council, has talked about in regards to offsets. So I think their position is evolving. I think partly it will depend on what happens with regulatory frameworks and integrity standards, kind of coming out of the fallout of the last couple of years of all this investigative reporting about how incredibly ineffective and what a scam most offsets have been. So with that kind of caveat, one thing that AFRC president has talked about is a general line of, like, we're opposed to carbon offsets, and this is kind of my paraphrasing and reduction of it a little bit. We're opposed to carbon offsets unless we can sell carbon offsets for what we're already doing. They don't want to have to change any of their behavior or business practices. They don't want to extend their harvest rotations, so let their trees grow longer. Right now, they're often cut on about a 40-year timeline. They don't want to have to change what they're doing at all. They're okay with carbon offsets if they can sell carbon offsets for what they're already doing. You know, we're okay with it if we get free money, but if it requires us to do anything differently, then not so much.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer with Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about the upcoming conference that used to be called, more honestly, Who Will Own the Forest? Now it's called Canopy. And it's going to be happening in conjunction, so to speak, with a couple events that Alex is involved with organizing called Forest Over Profits. So those are the two different viewpoints, I guess, that we're going to have on display next week of how we can relate to our forests. As you're talking about Barbara Haya, I've actually been listening to her voice a lot as I'm editing my new documentary about false climate solutions. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember her saying something like 83% of carbon offsets don't work. And they're just a total scam and sham.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what impact that's having on this huge carbon market, which is what a lot of governments, their whole approach towards decarbonization has to do with carbon offsets and carbon credits. So how is this going to impact all of that?
I mean, to me, so far, it seems like kind of a just cover your ears, shut your eyes, la, 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 kind of a rejection of, yeah, there's not any, seems to be any interest in like stepping back and think maybe we need to rethink this. And I mean, I think that largely comes down to the fact that capitalism is incompatible with a livable climate. And the only way you can kind of make it look like it can work on paper is with things like incredible carbon removal technologies that don't actually exist yet, and huge carbon offset markets. Because without that, a lot of these big companies, you know, if they were actually held accountable for their emissions, like there's no way that they could continue to operate. So I think that's kind of the underlying tension that hasn't really come out publicly yet, or that we aren't really wrestling with, is that there's not a simple, easy solution here, like carbon offsets, and that there's some more fundamental, there's a more fundamental conflict here between capital and a livable planet.
Well, the investigative reporting that you mentioned, and I can't remember which magazine it was in, but I mean, it's an excellent piece, but I'm not sure how widely it got out. And other than that, I mean, Barbara Haya speaks to an academic audience, mm-hmm. and occasionally to reporters. And she's great. I mean, I think she said some really powerful things, and I'm looking forward to putting her voice out on the radio and on the film that's going to come out. But I think that I'm just wondering what kind of strategy there is to get the word out in ways that will make it more effective. I'm kind of thinking the way that Al Gore really brought to the surface up front the crisis of climate chaos with his movie An Inconvenient Truth, now like 20 years ago.
Right. Well, there's kind of two things I want to say about that. The first, a bit more contained on the, you know, the implications of research like Barbara's and that reporting. I don't know if you're referring to, I forget who the reporter was, but there was an amazing piece about the carbon offset company called South Pole in the New Yorker, I believe.
It was that one, and it's about it's about the carbon offsets that are being sold in Africa.
Yes.
And again, I'm concerned that you look at that and go, well, that's going on in Africa. But in fact, as Barbara Haya said, most of the offset programs are forest offsets, and there's a lot of them in the United States.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know if it was Barbara's research or someone else, but there was a study, I think, last year. Maybe it was the year before, that reviewed the carbon offset program in California to kind of evaluate its effectiveness, and found that more than 90% of those credits were basically worthless. That the area, the forest areas, especially private timberland that were under carbon offset designations, were not being logged any less than, you know, areas that were not designated as carbon offset. So there was no actual change to management. We know logging is a huge contributor to climate change in Oregon. It's the single largest source of climate pollution. So if we're selling carbon offsets for forests, but we're not changing the way we're managing those forests, in particular private plantation industrial forests, then it's an absolute scam. The one kind of response that I've seen to that is there's an organization that kind of came together of folks within the forest or carbon offset industry in the wake of a bunch of this reporting, that is creating some voluntary carbon offset standards with the goal of, like, we got enough of the serious people together. We can kind of put out, here's what the standards are for integrity, and that can stabilize the carbon offset market and give companies that would be buying carbon offsets, investing in that sector, in their language, the trust to know that it's real, that it's, these are credits that have, you know, if they have this certification, then they're legitimate. Because I think that's something that came out of the reporting, is that a lot of these companies that were exposed for being complete shams and frauds were some of the biggest players out there. And I think it left a lot of companies that are looking to buy carbon offsets with a sense of, like, well, if we can't trust them, like, who can we trust? We don't want the bad press of buying carbon offsets and claiming it as, you know, we're doing so good. And then 6 months later, a report comes out that it's a total sham. And, you know, we were defrauded or scammed, or we look like idiots then. So I think that's kind of the response that I've seen. It's a bit technocratic, certainly, not something that probably most people have heard of, but that is an ongoing effort to try and create some integrity standards. I think it's an open door as to whether having those integrity standards, what they come up with, will be meaningful. I mean, I think Barbara's research indicates that it's really hard to actually design any offset program that leads to real emissions reductions and offsets. So I think, yeah, I hope also that we don't get distracted by that, that when, you know, some technocratic working group at the international level comes out and says, we've created these standards and we're certifying people now. And so now we can all trust that these carbon offsets are real. I don't believe they're, we'll see. I'm curious what Barbara and others say, but I'm highly skeptical that they'll be able to address the real fundamental problems there.
Well, I know that I've talked to a number of people who think that the whole concept of carbon offsets is flawed. First of all,
right. The
idea that you pay somebody else to not do what you're doing that's bad. And I remember many years ago hearing them compared to indulgences from the medieval Catholic Church.
Yeah, if I, you know, I might want to use child labor in my sweatshop, my factory, but I don't want, you know, the negative, you know, public image repercussions of that. So I'll pay you to not use any child labor. So we're net neutral child labor, net zero child labor, even though I've got children working in my factory for me. I'm paying you not to have children working for you. But I mean, there's all kinds of ways that, you know, when you actually unpick this, it kind of falls apart. Like, were you actually going to hire children? Was that something you were about to do before I handed you that cash? So yeah, there's not really a way to design them. And Barbara can speak to this obviously much more articulately. There's not really a solution here.
Her colleague, Denny Collingworth, who's also in San Francisco, talks about how the whole concept of carbon offsets, particularly forest offsets, is flawed because it used to be the idea that since greenhouse gas emissions are a global concern, it doesn't matter where you emit them, it doesn't matter where you decrease where they are.
Yeah.
But however, that what we know now about carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases is that they're going to be there forever. Mm-hmm. And so things like carbon offsets for not logging for 50 years or 80 years doesn't really solve the problem because, and this is a quote from Danny in my show, he says, forever is forever.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, there's not really, I mean, it's all kind of a shell game. And I think it really exposes this deeper tension of how can we make it look on paper like things are all right? And this reduction of climate change to just a problem of measurements and technology and data and really being about how can we control the world and kind of treating it like with forests in particular, this feels so obvious to me, treating the world like a fish tank. Like forests, if we let them grow, their ecosystems, they, you know, forests will become old growth and go through cycles where they burn and then regrow. They're really good at sequestering carbon. They're not good at sequestering carbon when we're planting them, you know, in tightly packed rows with only one species and taking many of the other species that, you know, they depend on and live with out of the equation. And calling that, you know, carbon removal. It feels like treating the world like a fish tank. And there's all this work that you have to put into it of keeping the pH just right and the chemicals and cleaning the tank and the food. And, you know, ponds and rivers and lakes do that for free. And they do it much better than we can do it when we try and replicate it with, you know, AI and drones and all these new tools that are coming into this, you know, forest offset sector.
Well, do you think there's a chance that there will be actually stricter controls on what's considered a bona fide carbon offset, and if the who will own the forest people don't want to change their practices, how does that affect their ability to buy and sell carbon offsets?
I mean, I think they're only going to do it if it's profitable for them. That's, you know, that's another deeper incentive here, is that all of this is happening within the context of capitalism, where, you know, generating, especially for these Wall Street investor-owned companies, they have their highest obligation above all else is to generate the greatest returns for their investors as possible. There's been a bit of an effort in the last 5 years to, you know, how do we factor in ESG and, you know, the benefit of the social outcome, the positive social outcomes of reducing the impacts of climate change and everything. But we're also seeing a backlash to that. So as long as that underlying logic of you have to make as much money for your shareholders as possible remains intact, any offset scheme put on top of that is always going to be subservient to that. So then it's, you know, it only will, they're only going to engage in those kinds of programs if it is financially sound for them, if it helps them make more money than they would by doing what they're already doing. And I mean, that's the framing even from this conference, from the Who Will Own the Forest Canopy conference, the kind of elevator pitch for this year's conference is, quote, growing awareness of climate change is generating a new wave of interest in forests beyond the traditional focus on timber assets. While timber remains a fundamental driver in many forest portfolios, some investors are entering the asset class to meet net zero climate resilience, conservation, or biodiversity goals. Again, this is still a within this larger frame of capitalism needing to generate a profit, that requires that the cost of carbon be low enough that they can still make money off of it. And I think that's a problem that we've seen kind of crop up with a lot of conversations around pricing carbon in some way and carbon markets, is that as long as the market is defined by profit logic and imperative, the price of carbon needs to be really low, which is just, you know, incommensurate with the impacts that climate change is going to have and the devastation that it's going to cause. It's just, there's a mismatch there fundamentally.
What kind of pressure do you think can be put on these industries, and particularly on the financial services, that we'd start to see that carbon offsets are really not good business and just take that out of the portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some opportunity there. I think we've seen, so kind of happening right now at the same time in a very different kind of, very different direction, the federal government and the Forest Service are revising the Northwest Forest Plan, which I know we talked about a couple months ago when I was on the show. For anyone who isn't familiar with that, the Northwest Forest Plan is a regional management plan for federally managed forests in the Pacific Northwest. It covers 17 national forests and some other federal lands. They're going through over the last year, they've been going through negotiations with representatives from tribes and timber industry and academics and some conservation voices, kind of figuring out what all should the new plan look like, what's important, what are priorities, you know, looking ahead 30 years, since that's how long it's been since the plan was first implemented and this is the first revision. And one of the things that's come out of that process is an acknowledgement by the timber industry that they realize and understand that it is no longer socially acceptable to log big old growth trees. They know that's not on the table, so they're not trying to get those trees to the mill anymore. They know that that's just so publicly disapproved of that they're not even going to try anymore. So with that now, the fight is really shaping up to be over mature forests that, you know, trees that are under 120 years old, the old growth of the future. It's important that we protect that. Folks should keep an eye out. The draft environmental impact statement for that Northwest Forest Plan revision is going to be coming out, I believe, the end of October. And there'll be opportunities for public comment around that. And it's really important that people weigh in. But I share that story just as an example of, it took decades to shift the timber industry there and to pressure them away from logging old growth. But that has been successful. And, you know, the fact that they acknowledge now that it's no longer publicly acceptable to log big old trees is a result of the organizing and grassroots community pressure.
But it seems equally important to keep them from logging mature forests.
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of gets to this bigger issue of, what if our forests were managed by the communities living with them for carbon removal and old growth and resilience to fire? There's a lot of opportunity for work and jobs there at the local level. But when they're managed under this Wall Street profit imperative, where the money's leaving the community, where trees are being cut, you know, on 40 years, not because that generates the most board feet of lumber, but because that generates the highest and quickest rate of return for their Wall Street investors. You know, that's just such a divergent thing there. So I think it's important to push back on these things. And I think that's something that hopefully we're starting to see more of in the climate movement, is a focus on these false solutions and calling that out, both as a way to open up the conversation and highlight these more fundamental challenges with capitalism, but also to, you know, kind of a rearguard action to stop as much damage in the short term as possible while we worked for those larger transformations.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBSG LPF and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer with Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about forests over profits. I want to get back to biomass, which we just kind of skirted around, because that's been a very big issue for the last year, since
yes.
Drax has these plans. Amongst one of the five facilities that they're proposing is one in Longview, which is a city that has been bedeviled by the worst plans of industrial development, mostly fossil fuel.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to talk a bit about that project, and then this whole thing of transitioning from horrible fossil fuel projects to what are being portrayed as green, renewable biomass projects.
Yeah. So Drax is a company. It's a British company. It's named after the town of Drax, where it originated. It was originally a coal company, which is a bit of a tell. last year, I guess 2 years ago, they took the initial steps. They're hoping to build a biomass pellet export plant in Longview, just downriver from Portland here. They've also got some proposals in Northern California in Lassen County to build some biomass pellet export plants there. There's another one in Hoquiam, Grays Harbor area proposed by a different company. We've heard rumors that there's potentially something gearing up in the works for Coos Bay, speaking of, you know, coastal towns that have just borne the brunt of these boom and bust promises of big moneyed corporations. So where that process is at right now, Drax submitted their application for an air permit under the Clean Air Act to the state agency in Washington that grants, you know, that evaluates and issues those permits. Last year, that agency, the Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington, initially released a draft in March, I believe, or the end of February, and was accepting public comment. And they got so much pushback right away that they actually withdrew the permit and have been asking for more information from Drax, being a lot more critical or like taking a much closer look. So we're expecting another draft of that air permit to come out. We're not sure when, sometime soon. We had heard maybe it would happen in August. That obviously didn't happen, so it could be any time in the next few months, or maybe it'll be 6 months from now. That's how this stuff goes oftentimes, is it's hurry up and wait, and then suddenly it's, you know, all hands on deck. But there's already been a lot of community pushback. Longview already has, you know, worse air quality because of industry than a lot of other communities in Washington. These pellet mills put out a lot of pollutants, and there's been some really groundbreaking studies done that are currently in process in the, speaking of the South and the Southeast, in Georgia and Mississippi, who have been dealing with these plants in their communities for a lot longer. And there's the air pollution. There's, you know, these companies always say, oh, we're only going to take forest waste, the like limbs and not trees, but, you know, the leaves and the twigs and all the stuff that the timber companies don't use, and just extra sawdust from the mills. And inevitably, they always end up taking whole trees. And so it always drives more logging. There's also just the noise and truck traffic that these mills run a thing called a hammer mill, which is a machine louder than a jet engine, just hammering away, pounding the pellets down 24/7. So there's a bunch of really negative, awful impacts, and folks in Longview are upset, and folks across the region are increasingly keying in, as you said, kind of alluding, this feels like a natural extension of the Thin Green Line fight of the last 15, maybe 20 years now, to stop the fossil fuel export projects that were proposed for coal, oil, and gas along the Pacific coast. And this, yeah, it's a similar thing. It's really interesting to put it in that context, because we know that burning trees for energy can be as or even more polluting than coal when it comes to climate change. So it's certainly not green energy. There is essentially a very manipulative accounting error that in the 90s, during the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, I believe, that kind of just declared biomass to be carbon neutral. And these industries are continuing to milk that and benefit from it. So yeah, in contrast to the coal, oil, and gas, you know, the companies and corporations and industry boosting these new biomass plants and industry are hyping it up as this is clean energy, it's green. The trees sucked carbon in their whole lives. Never mind that we cut them down, emitted a bunch of that carbon, and now going to burn them to emit the rest. So there's definitely, they're framing it, but I mean, fundamentally, it's the same thing. Big corporations, Wall Street investors coming into communities and sacrificing them, whether that community itself with the air pollution and the direct impacts there, or also cutting and logging more of our forests and preventing them from actually being a climate solution by being allowed to grow and mature and absorb and sequester that carbon.
Well, I'm sort of wrestling with two things that you've said over the last while here. Okay. One is that the who own the forest people think that they are the true environmentalists, that they really know more about forests than people like you. And then the other part of it is that these new supposed green energy sources like biomass or like renewable diesel are being, again, portrayed as this is really the green future. Mm-hmm. And yet, of course, it's very easy to undercut that, but it seems like it's harder because on the one hand, these people are saying, we are the experts, right, looking down on everybody else. And on the other hand, these experts and some other of their allies are saying, and we have the green solutions.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an effort there to frame themselves as the very serious people who have the solutions. And, you know, the rest of us should just shut up and sit down and, you know, let these, I don't know, timber elites solve the problem for us. I mean, fortunately, there are a lot of other voices, whether, you know, those are indigenous communities that have been on the front lines of climate change, both here in North America and around the world, and the front lines of extractive logging projects, the front lines of these carbon offset projects, or, you know, academic researchers that have done some amazing work really countering these narratives and stories put out and backed by the timber industry, folks like Dr. Beverly Law and Chris Dunn and Susan Simard. So there's like a wealth of knowledge and expertise there. But yes, they certainly kind of try and claim that high ground and position themselves as a solution. I mean, again, I think though, it's, you don't have to scratch the surface very deeply for it to see what a sham that is. And I think that's kind of what they're relying on. And, you know, that goes back to rebranding the conference as well of, you know, we'll put up this, we'll literally greenwash ourselves. It's a really thin coat of paint. But as long as no one looks, you know, behind the curtain or scratches or picks at it, it sounds really great on the surface. So I think that's the role of, I mean, communities facing, you know, these projects that would sacrifice their well-being and our forests, but also the role of, you know, organizations and community groups and activists to push back and to call them out.
Well, people who live on the fence lines of these projects, whether it's on the fence line of a biomass wood pellet factory, mm-hmm. or whether it's on the fence line of a renewable diesel refinery, those people know what it's about, and they can see through the greenwashing.
Yeah.
But I wonder how we spread the word beyond the people who are directly impacted. Also the tribes, who, for the large part, know what it's about. Though I've heard Thomas Joseph complain that some of the tribal councils get bought, and they get sort of sold on some of these false promises.
No community is a monolith.
Yeah, and certainly. So there's even issues there. But I wonder how the people who really know how bad it is, how their voices can be elevated to get to the same level as the people who say, we know what's really good for the planet.
Through a lot of hard work and perseverance, I think is a short answer there. I mean, some years ago when I was living in Southern Oregon, we put together a project where we brought folks on the front lines of the proposed Jordan Cove natural gas export pipeline and facility. We took them to Colorado, to Western Colorado, where, you know, the company backing it had been saying, this is going to be gas from the Rockies, from Colorado, and it's going to, these communities really want this pipeline to be built so that, you know, they get more jobs and money from more drilling. And we knew, and, you know, in Colorado, they were telling folks who opposed, you know, more fracking there, you know, these folks in Oregon really want this pipeline to be built because it'll bring all this investment and money to their community. You don't want to stand in the way of that. I mean, there's definitely, with these big industries, a very old playbook of, you know, divide and conquer. And so we had a project where we brought folks on the front lines from Oregon to Colorado to meet with folks on the ground there dealing with the fracking, and brought some of those folks out to Oregon to meet with folks on the front lines. And I think really that kind of bridging work and bringing people together, I mean, it's so easy to feel isolated and alone, and finding ways that bring the communities facing these disparate injustices and projects together to like find that common power and figure out how can we work together and how can we see our individual struggles, the specific bad thing that we're fighting in our town, as connected to bad things happening in other towns, and then tell that larger story.
So how did that all work out?
It was lovely. It was really nice. It was great to have that exchange of folks. It really, I think, was inspiring for people on both sides. It was not surprising, but it was really amazing to see how energized people were hearing from folks on the other end of, you know, the production pipeline, I guess, how energizing it was for folks and how much excitement there was in Coos Bay, how many people came out to hear, you know, someone from Colorado come out and talk about the struggles of their communities fighting fracking. And likewise, how interested folks in Colorado were to hear about, you know, what's going on the ground, because they don't, you know, there's, as connected as our world is with social media now, I think we have kind of, maybe we've surpassed that point of just, social media, we're all so connected now, and realize that actually we're incredibly fragmented as connected as we are and in bubbles. So I think people don't often realize, you know, how many other people are out there fighting, you know, struggling against the same kinds of corporations and the same larger systems that make our lives hard, and are killing our future, and finding that common ground. And just, it's so easy to see yourself in other people that way, that I think it's a really powerful way to build solidarity and connection and build larger movements. And that's something that we've started to talk about with folks in British Columbia and in the Southeast, in Georgia, Mississippi, about how can we do some storytelling and bringing together folks from these communities that are facing the same things to you know, as part of that project of building a larger movement, but also as a, you know, finding more collective power there.
And after 17 years, Jordan Cove LNG was defeated.
Oh, yeah, finally.
I wonder if it's going to take that long to defeat Drax.
We'll see. I think a lot of it depends on what happens with subsidies. I mean, this, all these pellet plants on the West Coast, they all kind of popped up at once after the Inflation Reduction Act and some of these other policies in the US, and we're also seeing this in other parts of the world, in Europe as well. There's suddenly this glut of public money to fund, I mean, anything that can, you know, put that green veneer of like, we're a solution to climate change, and we don't, we can allow the world as it is and the systems that exist currently to continue operating. So there's this flood of money for those things. And I mean, in the Pacific Northwest with the biomass stuff, it kind of dovetails or intersects with the flood of money around supposed wildfire risk reduction, which has mainly been reduced to, we just need fewer trees in the forest and then we won't have these big fires. And I mean, the research is very clear that these extreme fires, like the 2020 Labor Day fires, the Camp Fire in Paradise and others, these fires are driven primarily by weather, which is climate impacted as well, leading to stronger winds and, you know, more intense droughts and heat waves, that's what's driving these really big fires. But it's a lot harder to address climate change and control the weather than it is to just label, there's, you know, too many trees in the forest, which, you know, it does make sense on some level. If you're camping and you build a little fire, the more wood you put on the fire, the bigger it burns. So like, it's understandable why that is somewhat intuitive and makes sense as an explanation, even though the research is pretty clear that that's not what's driving these extreme fires. But because of that, there's now a ton of money, including the IRA and the Infrastructure Act, to thin public forests. And I don't think there's been an effort to really think too critically about this in terms of how much money and how much labor it would take to actually thin every couple of years every acre of the backcountry forest, so tens of millions of acres across the region. And as part of that effort to try and make that scalable, the federal government and other governments and agencies are looking for ways to generate a little bit of income to help support that. And that's where the biomass thing comes in, is the biomass company will say, we'll take all your, you know, extra slash and these small trees that you cut and all the extra limbs and all this woody biomass that you generate when you're, you know, thinning forests. And we can buy it from you at a bargain price for them, but for the Forest Service, they're still getting some income out of it. So it's kind of like I think that's part of the scheme and the rush right now. So all of that is to say that whether we'll still be fighting, you know, projects like Drax in 17 years, I sure hope not. There's a lot of other things I'd rather be doing. But I think it in large part will depend on where, you know, these big pots of money, how that's flowing. And is there still this effort to pump a bunch of money into the system around this stuff, or has that faded away?
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KPFG up here from KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer with Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, about forests over profits. Well, I saw an article in the Oregonian, I guess it was last week, talking about the money that's the state is trying to earmark for thinning forests to prevent forest fire. And then the article happened to mention that all the big fires in Oregon this year were not in forests, they were grassland.
Yeah.
And there was almost the connect. I mean,
you're so close. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of this is the world is a lot more complex and nuanced than, you know, press release sound bites allow it to be reflected as. Yeah, I mean, that's more fires start on private land and escape private lands into, you know, public forest land than vice versa. And yet the narrative is very clearly that it's the Forest Service, you know, not logging enough that is causing all these fires. I mean, I think there's definitely an effort by the timber industry to exploit this. I mean, people feel, I mean, even folks who haven't directly had to leave their homes or had their homes destroyed in these communities or lost loved ones, even folks who are a little bit more peripheral to it, like there's a lot of fear in the summer when, you know, it gets really smoky. And having lived in rural Oregon for most last 10 years, that anxiety is, it's real, and it's, I think we underestimated our own peril. So there's a real, I think, emotional reaction here, and that's not to, I don't say that to diminish it, but just to acknowledge, I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. And people are hungry for someone to say, here's the solution. If we just do X, then we'll be fine and you'll be safe and you'll have, you know, security in this way that you feel precarious now. And that's a really hard thing to work around. And I mean, it's just back to the false solutions thing with climate change more broadly of, how we understand the problem does a lot to inform what kinds of solutions or responses we'll consider worth investing in and which ones we'll ignore. And I think there's a distinction that can be really helpful between is this a problem that has a solution or a predicament that does not have a solution? So some things are problems and you can solve them. There is a right way to respond, or at least you can, you can solve the problem. Some things are predicaments where there's not an easy solution. There's a variety of potential responses. All of those responses will have different consequences and force you to make different decisions. But I find that to be a helpful distinction. And I think both climate change and what we can call the wildfire crisis are examples of that. If we're hungry for simple solutions that, you know, if only we do X, then we'll be safe, then, you know, we won't have to worry about this anymore. And unfortunately with climate change, like, we just, the cat is out of the bag on that one. It's going to be hundreds of years at least before, you know, we can get carbon back down to 280 parts per million or 300 parts per million. So how are we going to live in the meantime, and how do we minimize the damage, and how do we learn to live with more precarity and anxiety and less certainty about, you know, future stability? And that, I mean, that's the, in some ways, that's not a compelling message. That's not something people want to hear particularly. I mean, you know, it's a lot more comforting to hear, you know, I've got the solution, and if only you give me the money and cut the red tape, then everything will be fine. But I think that's kind of the emotional logic underneath a lot of these corporate industry-backed responses to both climate change and the wildfire crisis.
Well, in our final few moments, I want to talk again about these conferences that are coming up. And I don't know if you want to mention it on air. Is anybody from your side intending to attend the Who Will Own the Forest conference?
I don't know. I mean, they release a list of the organizations that people attend from after the fact. But I don't know of anyone that's going to be on the inside. But, you know, there's lots of people, and it's a big movement. So
who's going to be on the outside?
Yeah, so there's two events that folks have been organizing in response to the Who Will Own the Forest Canopy Conference under the broad banner of Forests Over Profits, like you mentioned at the top. So the first is on Tuesday the 24th. That'll be tomorrow, I believe, when this airs. At 5:30 p.m., there's a No False Solutions teach-in. So if you've been interested in what we've been talking about today around things like carbon offsets and biomass, and even just those larger questions of how corporations, the rich and big polluters, are using schemes that don't actually address the root causes of the climate crisis and won't actually, you know, alleviate the damage or mitigate the harm that's coming with that, to avoid accountability, you should come to the False Solutions teach-in. That's at 5:30 on Tuesday the 24th at the 350 PDX office, which is at 3639 North Mississippi Avenue. We're going to have speakers from 350 PDX and also Thomas Joseph with Indigenous Environmental Network, and Julia Bernal, who's the executive director of the Pueblo Action Alliance and the New Mexico No False Solutions Coalition, talking about some of the work they've been doing down there. So really exciting. I think it's going to be amazing and really informative. So if you're interested in this false solutions stuff and want to learn more about that and how a lot of that's working, and kind of look behind the curtain and get the rundown from some really smart, amazing, powerful speakers, come on the 24th at 5:30 at 350 PDX. And then there's also a big rally, a big protest during the Who Will Own the Forest conference. That's going to be at noon on Wednesday the 25th at the World Forestry Center.
And hopefully it won't be pouring rain like it was last year.
We're crossing our fingers, but we're prepared to be flexible and adapt as needed. So yeah, come join us. This will be happening right as actually the conference is on its lunch break. And they typically serve lunch outside. So we'll be rallying and sending a message where these Wall Street investor types can, they'll definitely be able to hear us and know that we're there. And we want them to know that for anyone looking at maybe, you know, sinking a bunch of new money into things like carbon offsets and biomass extractive industrial timber, that this is a bad investment and that they'd be taking on the risk of having to deal with this growing movement of community resistance.
So is there any way to get any information inside the conference, do you think?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
You could leaflet.
Yeah. So last year we did have some folks that were, you know, kind of standing at the entrance, the door, the gate, you know, having conversations with people from the conference coming and going. I imagine there'll be some of that this year. I mean, it's there's a lot of different people involved who come to the, you know, Forest Over Profits mobilization with different things that they're excited about. And, you know, I think in general, I encourage anyone who is feeling motivated and wants to have a conversation with, you know, someone from Weyerhaeuser or one of these carbon offset firms and, you know, have that heart to heart, like, go do it. They'll be there, you know, all week, Tuesday night through Thursday at lunch. And if you want to come to the rally and speak out, do that. If you want to learn more, come to the teach-in on the 24th. There's all kinds of ways to be involved.
And I'm wondering what you're thinking about next year's conference, if there's any way that maybe what could be done between now and then that next year's conference might have a different tone.
Do you mean the World Forestry Center's conference?
Yes, that one. Yes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they continue this shift of rebranding. We know that the World Forestry Center has some plans to really lean into, I mean, let's call it what it is, propaganda around, you know, increasing timber harvests and wildfire smoke. You know, that's something they're going to be doing a lot of work around. So, yeah, we'll see. But we're going to be, I think we're going to have some bigger plans next year as well. I don't have much to share about that now, just saying we're also thinking ahead. And I think next year is going to be even bigger for profits.
I find it interesting how they have shifted to the kind of greenwashing that they're doing, as opposed to just saying we should log our forests and talking about everything in terms of board feet. So there's been a difference, and yet they're so cagey. I mean, the same with the fossil fuel industry,
right,
the way that they rebrand themselves. But I just wonder how we slice through that. I mean, that's the thing that keeps me up at night, is how do we cut through this greenwashing propaganda?
Yeah. I mean, I don't. If you come up with a solution to that question, definitely give me a call, Barbara. I think there's a lot of us that are wondering that. I mean, I think that's, I'm really optimistic that the centering false solutions more could be really helpful in that regard. I mean, for the last several decades, kind of the overarching mission of the climate movement has been to get decision makers and the public and society and corporations and businesses to take climate change seriously as a real threat, something that we need to deal with. And I think we've largely been successful in that. I think, you know, kind of cresting with the climate movements of 2018, 2019, and the Inflation Reduction Act that came out of that, and some of the policies that have been passed in Europe as well. And I think now folks like Biden and Bill Gates and the timber industry and a lot of these industries, the fossil fuel industry, for example, we're seeing them do their best to take climate change seriously. And it's so incredibly inadequate, obviously. But I think it's time to shift our focus. And I think focusing on these false solutions allows us to highlight those issues more instead of moving a bit away from, or maybe just in addition to, you know, the work, the amazing and tireless work that's been done by so many people over the last couple of decades around raising the alarm about climate change and the threat it poses, I think we need to hone in more on the responses from a lot of these governments, from industries and capitalism, are taking us down the wrong path, and we need to call that out and not let them get away with it. And I think that needs to be a focus more moving forward.
Well, Alex, thanks so much for being on Locus Focus, and thanks for sharing all the information about these upcoming conferences and workshops and rallies.
Thanks. Yeah. Join us on Tuesday the 24th at 5:30 at 350 PDX, and on noon the 25th at the World Forestry Center.
We've been talking with Alex Budd, Alliance Organizer with Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends and family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff and volunteers who continue to do an incredible job of making KBOO the important community resource that it is. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, grass-fed, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll get an update on the latest news from the Willamette River North Reach with Sarah Taylor with the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group. We'll go out with Trees by Lori Lewis. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
We stand waiting at the edges of your fields. We stand just waiting for the time when the plow's bright blade will turn to rust and the earth will heal from the vicious cut. We stand waiting at the edges of your fields. You are but the shadow of a cloud across the land. Here a moment, then you're gone again. And we will sprout from your foundations and break the bounds between your nations. Though you build your monuments, they will not stand.
Hey, everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence.